You're listening to 3CR, 855 AM. Let's go now to Nick McClellan, who is a renowned journalist, a Pacific researcher. In this segment, he talks about the ongoing fallout of the bombing of Hiroshima on Australia and the former Pacific colonies, the Pacific Island nations, and existing, local activism against nuclear weapons and testing, and parallels between the build-up during the Second World War and what's happening today.
Tinian Island. Tinian's a small island in the Marianas Islands. They're a Micronesian island archipelago in the Western Pacific, north of Guam, which is a US territory seized at the end of the US-Spanish War. And Tinian was held by Japan in the late 30s, early 40s. And as those old enough to remember, the Americans fought their way through the Pacific Islands from Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands, through Tarawa in what's today Kiribati, Peleliu in Palau, many island battles with US Marines storming ashore to fight entrenched Japanese forces. So they did on Tinian, which they captured in July 1944. And its value at that time was because it was close to Japan, so bombers could fly from Tinian to reach the Japanese mainland and get back. So they built four airstrips on Tinian Island. They were the longest airstrips in the world at that time. And they deployed B-29 bombers onto Tinian. And even before the events of the 6th and 9th of August, the use of nuclear weapons, they were involved in bombing raids against Japan in 1945. On the 9th of March, planes were filled up with incendiary devices and firebombed Tokyo. Many Japanese houses were built of wood and timber and paper, and 100,000 people died from the fires that ripped through the Japanese city. The same bombers were used laying mines around the coast of Japan in an operation, surprise, surprise, called Operation Starvation. And the aim was that they would cut off food supplies to the civilian population of Japan as a way of trying to drive the Japanese leadership towards ending the war. And you only have to think about firebombing, about starvation, to draw the parallels today to what's happening in Gaza. The bomb was first exploded in the New Mexico desert, on land where indigenous peoples have been displaced, on the 16th of July, the Trinity test. Very quickly, they decided that they would use atomic weapons, and they had a list of cities they were going to bomb. Kyoto was top of the list, until some architects and art historians said, that's, you know, such a beautiful city, can't we put that further down the list? So Hiroshima was first, and the Enola Gay took off from Tinian early on the morning of the 6th of August and dropped the bomb. By year's end, 140,000 people in Hiroshima had died. The next city on the list was Kokura, and the plane took off, Boxcar was the name of the second plane, took off on the morning of the 9th of August, but the weather was bad over Kokura, so they turned back and dropped it on Nagasaki instead. 74,000 people by year's end had died from the blast, the fires, radiation exposure, and so on. The survivors of nuclear weapons, the so-called Hibakusha of Japan, and also Koreans, some Australian, British prisoners of war, were exposed to ionising radiation and have lived with the consequences ever since. And for the people of Tinian, though, there are strong memories. And I've just written an article. I interviewed some young people in Tinian just last month. And they said for their parents, their grandparents, there were enormous memories of this. And this young woman, Issa Ariola, I spoke to, said, we're still finding unexploded ordnance on the beach from the war between Japan and the United States some 80 years ago. And all around the Pacific, in Solomon Islands, in Papua New Guinea, Kiribati, in Palau, people are still being injured or maimed. Some die from unexploded ordnance that decades later is a hazard for people. The striking thing is that today, Tinian is being rebuilt as a military base. After the war, the Americans established a series of military bases all through the Western Pacific, from Japan to Okinawa, of course in Australia, with the presence of bases like Pine Gap, Northwest Cape and others that were involved in their naval deployments, and particularly on Guam, which is a US territory, Micronesian island just south of Tinian. And today, more than a quarter of the land area of Guam is taken up by US military bases. Anderson Air Force Base, Apra Harbor Naval Base, a naval air station, and just recently a new base for US Marines called Camp Blaz. And that's because for many decades there's been struggles in Okinawa to kick out the US troops that have been there for 80 years. And so they decided to move 8,000 or 10,000 Marines out of Okinawa elsewhere. The plan is that 5,000 of them will come to Guam. That's what this new military base is for. And when you do the maths, there's another 2,500, 3,000. Those are the ones that are rotating through northern Australia as we speak. Australia says, well, they're not being based in Australia, We have all year round deployments of units of US Marines that are operating in the Northern Territory. Similarly, the modern bombers, the B-52 bombers that were used back in the days of the Vietnam War but are still operational, fly through Kadena Air Base, Okinawa, Guam, and now Australia through Tyndall Air Base. Once again, B-52 bombers are rotating through Tyndall on a regular basis, and half of the fleet of B-52H bombers are capable of carrying nuclear weapons. Our Foreign Minister Penny Wong was asked in Parliament whether they'd asked the Americans, were they nuclear armed when they came to Australian territory? And she says, oh, we can neither confirm nor deny. So we've been very integrated into US warfighting strategies for many decades, as have neighbouring Pacific Island countries. But for the United States, the strategic challenge now today is not the rising power of Japan, but in fact the rising power of the People's Republic of China. And you only have to look at the headlines to see that that strategic competition between the US and China frames the geopolitics of our Asia-Pacific region today. And once again, as they were at the time of the Second World War, the Pacific Islands are in the midst of that competition. And what's striking is that the US is worried that with the spread of nuclear weapons to other countries, the growth of missile technology, that their bases in Guam will be threatened. Nowadays, North Korea, China have ballistic missiles capable of reaching Guam, even further afield to Hawaii. And so they have a program called Agile Employment, where they're building new air bases around small Micronesian countries so that at time of conflict, possibly over Taiwan or North Korea, they could disperse their forces to Palau, to the Federated States of Micronesia, and to Tinian. So the old airstrip from World War II that was used to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki is being rebuilt as we speak. One company, Fluor, big Texan construction company, got a $400 million contract to fix the airstrip. Another company from Guam, $200 million contract to build encampments and fuel and things like that. In Yap, the military spending $400 million to build an airstrip on Yap, a tiny Micronesian island in the Federated States of Micronesia. In Papua New Guinea, Australia and the United States have rebuilt Lombrum, which is on Manus. It's a deep water port, very useful. So all around the region, just as occurred during the Second World War, preparations for World War III are underway. What I want to say, though, that's important to stress is that Pacific Islanders have lived with the legacies of this ever since. You know, often people say, oh, they used the bomb to end the Second World War and it's never been used ever since. But as John said, that's not true. The United States, France and Britain developed their nuclear arsenals from the 1950s onwards by using their colonies in the Pacific, because throughout most of this time, the countries used for nuclear testing, bar Australia, were colonies of these Western powers. So the United States, straight after the war in 1946, started testing nuclear weapons in the Marshall Islands. 67 tests in the Marshall Islands, which is basically due north of Melbourne. Britain began, as we know, with nuclear tests in Australia, 1952 in the Montebello Islands, then later on the land of the Pitjantjatjara people of South Australia, at Maralinga and Emu Field. More tests that spread radioactivity across the continent, something that was documented in a Royal Commission held in 1985 under Justice Diamond Jim McClellan, no relative. France came later to the party. They began their tests in Algeria, in those days being a French colony in the Sahara Desert. In 1960, four atmospheric tests. Then it started doing underground tests in a place called Inekere, mountain range. They drilled holes in the side of the mountain, put a bomb in, plugged it up with concrete and let it off. In 1962, after a long and bitter war, a liberation war, the Algerian people gained their independence. But part of the deal was that France could maintain its military facilities in Algeria for another few years. So even after independence, they let off another 11 underground nuclear tests. Neither side wanted to talk about it. The Algerians, having won the war, didn't want to admit that part of the deal was that France could continue its nuclear testing. And while they did that, they built facilities in French Polynesia, Maui Nui, in the Eastern Pacific, facilities in Tahiti and airstrip on Hau, bases at Muruwa and Fangataufa atolls. And most of us will know that France conducted over 30 years, from 1966 to 1996, 193 nuclear tests at Muruwa and Fangataufa, some in the atmosphere, many underground. And the environment, the people, the economy have suffered from that to this day. And we often think of people as nuclear victims. But what I want to stress is that peoples in the Pacific and in Asia and in many parts of the world were not victims in this process, but indeed actors and participants, and they fought against it from the very beginning. In the Pacific Islands, one of the first anti-nuclear actions was by a Tahitian independence leader named Puvana Aopa, a charismatic Tahitian leader And in 1950, he took a copra boat out around the outer islands collecting signatures for the Stockholm Peace Statement, which gathered 32 million signatures across the world to ban the bomb. And throughout the 1950s, people in the Marshall Islands, in Western Samoa, in Cook Islands and other places, organised petitions which they sent to the United Nations Trusteeship Council calling for an end to nuclear testing because they were under trusteeship in those days. Now, the Western powers ignored those petitions, but it symbolised that from the very beginning, people were worried about the health and environmental effects, but also the impacts on land and on culture, on their very livelihoods. And so I want to stress that one of the important features is that that anti-nuclear struggle has continued right through the second half of the 20th century. You know, there were 50 years of nuclear testing in the Pacific from 1946 to the last French test in 1996. And all through that time, trade unions, women's groups, churches, but particularly Indigenous peoples, mobilised against that testing program. And so while this year is the 80th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima, it's also the 40th anniversary, on the 6th of August, Hiroshima Day this year, of the signing of the Rarotonga Treaty for the South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone. All the members of the Pacific Islands Forum, who are about to gather again in September of this year for their annual meeting, back in 1985-86, negotiated a treaty, a nuclear free zone treaty. And it was in the midst of the Reagan-Gorbachev arms build-up, people may remember, back in the 1980s, you know, the time of Star Wars and SS-20s and cruise missiles being deployed around the world. And the Pacific in the mid-80s said, no, enough is enough, and took a stand. Fast forward to today, we see the same process where neighbouring countries in the Asia-Pacific have signed on to the new Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW. An initiative that really began here in Melbourne with the founding of ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and as you'll know, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017. And TPNW is different because it's not an arms control treaty, like let's reduce the number of bombs or let's put technical limits on them. It's a nuclear abolition treaty. It's saying we want to get rid of all nuclear weapons. And the other unique element in it, and that's why it's had so much support from our Pacific neighbours, is unprecedented for a nuclear treaty. It has provisions about assistance to nuclear survivors for health and culture and environment, and about environmental remediation. And so many of our Pacific neighbours, in fact, Aotearoa New Zealand, which has been nuclear-free since 1987, unlike us, and 10 Forum Island countries have ratified TPNW. And even those that are still under colonial rule, like French Polynesia, Maui Nui, where the French are still, here we are, a quarter of the way through the 21st century, a colonial power, the Assembly of French Polynesia, just 2023, unanimously passed a resolution saying we support TPNW. We can't sign it because we're not an independent country, but it was symbolic that that anti-nuclear sentiment is still strong across the region. And it's true in Southeast Asia as well. The vast majority of members of ASEAN have signed and ratified the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Thailand, Malaysia, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and amazingly, last September, Indonesia. And you wouldn't know it if you read the Australian newspapers. You wouldn't know it if you read the ABC. And the very fact that Indonesia has said, we don't want to go nuclear, we want to abolish nuclear weapons. Those old enough in the room may remember in the 1960s, there was a serious debate in Australia about whether we should go nuclear and develop nuclear weapons. Back in the days of Harold Holt and John Gorton, there was a major discussion. And all the same cheer squad like Aspie and Lowy and all the think tanks today who are talking about it, talked about it in the 1960s because they were fearful of Indonesia under the Sukarno government. The Indonesians have decided, drawing on a history of non-alignment, let's not talk about what's going on in West Papua, that they don't want to join in the arms race. And that's amazing for Australia because most of ASEAN, most of the Pacific Islands Forum have said we want to abolish nuclear weapons, not just reduce their numbers, but get rid of them. The Albanese government says, well, that's Labor Party policy, that we should do so as well, but we are the only country of substance in this part of the world that hasn't done so. And I think that's a real challenge for the peace movement in Australia to think about how we work with our counterparts in Asia and in the Pacific to advance this. Because this is the debate. There's a concern that with American primacy under challenge, with the rise of China, with the madness of the Trump administration, that some countries like Korea or Japan are having a debate about whether to go nuclear. But most countries in Southeast Asia and the Pacific have said, we don't want to take that path. Now, Australia is on that path. You know, Richard Miles has just signed a 50-year treaty with the British, which I must say, as someone of Scottish heritage, I laugh at the English. But think about it, 50 years, that's 1975. Think about what the world was like 50 years ago, and think what the world's going to be like in 2075. And this is the madness of Australian policy at the moment, that they're talking about building a nuclear industry and pouring literally billions of dollars into changing our TAFE and university system to train a generation of nuclear specialists, taking up a nuclear policy that will integrate, even if that any more possible, Australia's military forces into American nuclear warfighting plans for the Asia-Pacific region. And there are a growing chorus of voices, ranging from people like Keating and Carr and others, to half of the defence think tank who realise that this is an incredible waste of money, and ordinary citizens who are saying, what sort of security are we talking about? And that's where we see the same spirit. You know, the generation who were affected by Hiroshima and Nagasaki are ageing and dying, but a younger generation are still living with the consequences, the environmental damage in these nuclear sacrifice zones around the Pacific, the intergenerational health effects. And that's why a younger generation in the Pacific Islands have picked up the torch to say, we support DPNW, we want Indigenous rights, we don't want our land used for military bases. And I think there's scope for us in Australia to link what we're doing with our neighbours. So thank you for your time, thank you for attention, but I think that's the core message. We need to look back at the horror of what happened in 1945, but we need to think about how it connects to today and the lessons that from the very beginning, people said no to the nuclear arms race, and that spirit continues in the 21st century.
And that was Nick McClellan, renowned journalist and Pacific researcher. He was speaking at an anniversary event hosted by Greek Democritus last Saturday in collaboration with 3CR affiliate organisation CICD, the Unitarian Church and FILEF.